Thank you, Anthony. Good morning, everyone. This is like my 8th or 9th time to visit Santa Barbara. And like always, I have been enjoying this atmosphere and science meeting very much. So my main part of today's talk will be the physics and chemistry in the low metallicity gas. So that is pretty much the theory part, and then much related to the galactic archaeology and the metal process, which will be covered actually by Rafael later today. But in the beginning, let me give a brief report on a new discovery of the oxygen 3 lines using ALMA, and actually based on cosmological simulation and so on. So because this is pretty new things. Our science paper has been published last week, so this is a good time for us to announce the new proof to the distant universe. With Ikko Shimizu now in Osaka University, we have been working for quite some time on the our early star-forming galaxies. So this is an output from our cosmological simulations showing the distribution of star-forming galaxies from redshift 3 or so to all the way to redshift 9. And we obviously noticed, these are like familiar objects, but we obviously noticed there are several or many sort of bright star-forming galaxies, even at redshift 8 or 9. The question is how to characterize and detect these galaxies. Well, this is just an ordinary cosmological simulation with the standard recipe of star formation and the feedback and so on. But one unique capability is that our simulation can generate this galaxy SED for individual galaxies such like this, even for this irregular galaxies with stellar distribution like this. So we have stellar light and nebular emission. We can make the consistent calculation of the dust attenuation and the re-emission in the far infrared. On top of it, we also calculate the emissivity of the far infrared lines, almost no, obvious, notably the carbon and oxygen lines. And you quickly recognize this prominent line of oxygen, 88 micron. Okay, so with these galaxy SEDs, we can make some predictions. So earlier in 2014, almost more than 2 years ago, we made this one particular prediction based on the simulation, saying, well, we will be able to use ALMA to detect and determine the spectral redshift of Z of 8 galaxies by using oxygen 3, 88 microns. Okay. Now, only one mistake we made back then was we really should have put redshift 7 here to be all consistent with our discovery. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. So this is our solid prediction. We can use the ALMA band 7 or 8 to detect these lines, even with only a 1 hour integration with ALMA cycle 2 or so. The prediction back then was like this. So among our galaxies, there are many of those even at redshift 7, 8, 9, with these luminosities. That shows the strong oxygen 3 emission above the so-called detection limit. If we can use the help of lensing, we can even detect all of them, basically, using ALMA. Our model was also calibrated with respect to the local observations of nearby dwarf galaxies and the 30 Doradas and the nearby spiral galaxies and so on. So based on these cosmological simulations and the calibrated emissivity of the oxygen 3, we are very confident to find these objects at a very high redshift. So our team of radio astronomers in Japan, they went to ALMA. Actually, they never went to ALMA, perhaps. You know, they did the remote observations, but this, they used this, the data from this. And discovers the most distant oxygen in the universe. This was a press release last week. And obviously, this is the artistic image of this particular galaxy, redshift 7. So I can tell you later, there has been a quiet discussion between the artists and us, like, you know, how does this galaxy look like? And they are realizing, like, yeah, exactly like this. And the artist of the asking, well, is the galaxy green or blue? And we are saying, well, it's a submillimeter, so there's no galaxy. But the artist was saying, like, well, it should be like any color or something. So in the end, we are accommodated with this green color because optical oxygen lines are just like in there. Anyway, yeah, just a side story. The real ALMA image is like this. This contour shows the oxygen 3 emissivity on top of the Lima alpha about this white scale Lyman alpha. So in this spectral domain, we see there 5 sigma detection of lesser frame 88 micron at redshift 7.2. The object is a known bright Lyman alpha emitter, so we have this Lyman alpha profile as well. And we notice this systematic velocity offset between Lyman alpha and oxygen speed lines of about 100 kilometers per second. I come back to this point later. So this particular galaxy compares well with the observed nearby galaxies and also with the simulated HiZ galaxies. Let me first compare this with these blue points are our observed target galaxy at redshift 7.2. So obviously it has a low metallicity, low oxygen abundance, like the central value is about 1/10 of the solar value. So the oxygen measurement comes from SED fitting, so it comes with large uncertainty. So one solar metallicity is still allowed, but the central value is here, just to be consistent with the simulated galaxies with this magnitude, UV magnitude of -21.5 or so. The predicted, the actual emissivity agrees well, or let's say consistent with the predicted values for several of these bright galaxies. One notable difference is the we didn't detect the dust continuum for this galaxy, so it must have a less amount of dust than assumed in our simulations. This is very indicative. Okay, so in a sense, I can say the simulation is wrong, over-predicting the amount of dust to this level. Compared with the nearby dwarf galaxies, green points, that's again like typical, like the ratio of oxygen 3 to 5 UV. Again, there is no detection of dust continuum, so this gives only the lower bound. So, but still, like if we take this lower bound value, it's kind of consistent. Interestingly, in band 6, we didn't detect the C2 lines for this object, so we can also place the line ratio of this to here. So this might appear peculiar compared to the local dwarf galaxies. Okay. So this is really the prominent oxygen 3 line at redshift 7.2. So the non-detection of C2 lines and the non-detection of a dust continuum and a relatively small velocity offset with respect to Lyman alpha all points to first the small amount of neutral hydrogen in this galaxy and a smaller amount of dust. And also they imply the favorable conditions for ionizing photons to escape from this galaxy. So this galaxy is probably the one of the main driver of the cosmic reionization of this epoch. So we could show or could give a sort of proof of concept of using these oxygen lines in at the epoch of reionization in this way. So of course we put many proposals to ALMA Cycle 3 and the others as well, including like lensed galaxies. So in the future, in the very near future, the line diagnostics will be possible. Okay, that observation so far. So this is my main part from now on about the physics of low metallicity gas. And this part is largely based on the thesis work of Gen Chiaki, who will be soon moving to Georgia Tech. So here, I'd like to describe rather details of the chemistry and the physics of the early star-forming gas cloud. So some of you might remember there used to be a time when we discussed the so-called critical metallicity. Like back then, we are thinking about the mode of star formation from pop 3 to pop 2. At some point, there must be critical metallicity above which the gas cools efficiently and then perhaps drives the formation of small mass clumps or low mass protostars and so on. So if there is such a metallicity value, then what is the key process? And the typical argument was because of the trace amount of carbon and oxygen, the fine structure cooling by these elements can cause the gas cool efficiently. The others, like people like Kazu and Rafaela, were saying, the cooling by dust thermal emission at even higher density might be the key to determine the availability or the ability of the gas cloud to produce many fragments. Okay? And back then, we used to use this so-called Omukai diagram showing the thermal evolution. This is the temperature and the density over many decades. As a function of gas metallicity, this is 10 to the minus 5 solar, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 3, and so on. Well, there is a variety of evolution, but we all notice this characteristic temperature dip here caused by the dust thermal emission. This is the result of the 1D calculation of Kazuo-Mukai. Okay, so then we could argue that the temperature dip really causes the gas to cool rapidly and then perhaps form fragments, low mass objects. And one nice example is this 3D calculation by Heidelberg group, including only the dust cooling, but this rapid temperature drop will produce tons of these small clumps. However, back then it was still unclear to me how exactly these small clumps are formed. And the result is clear. This formation occurs when this temperature drop occurs. But especially when one uses zinc particles, it remains unclear how exactly this happens. So we decided to readdress this issue using cosmological simulations and full chemistry, including molecular cooling. Okay? So we take three cosmological mini-hadrons from a previous simulation, as well as the one control simulation of spherical symmetry. Like, this is like a spherical collapse. But we make sure that the hadrons, the sample spans a wide parameter space, such as the degree of rotation and turbulence and the host halo spin and so on, so that we can see possibly the diversity. And our modeling, it's fairly complete, I would say. We follow all of these chemical evolution for 27 species, including silicon elements, a total of 54 reactions also in a non-equilibrium manner. We also include grain chemistry. The grain compositions are based on the calculation of Takaya Nozawa, who is around here, for the population 3 supernovae. Okay, so these elements include silicon ion and this one, the amorphous carbon, and so on. Okay. Later I showed that we also include the growth of these grain species. Okay. Associated chemical and radiative cooling, like these fine structure lines, CO molecular lines, and H2OOH, and so on. More importantly, we also appropriately include this H2 formation heating that turns out to be very important to dictate the thermal evolution. The overall result looks like this for four samples. So this each column shows the one particular object, but with different metallicities, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. So this is close to the very primordial composition. So you obviously notice quite a variety, even for the same metallicity or even for the same object. Okay. Some show the filamentary structure. The others show like a central object and the circumstellar disk and so on. So this time indicates the time elapsed since the formation of the first protostar. Beautiful. Now, let me answer first quickly the original question I asked. So does metallicity really determine everything? Obviously, no. Okay. Even for the same metallicity of 10 to the minus 4 solar value, spherical cloud and other cosmological halos shows they are vastly different. Their thermal revolution, the temperature and the density, they are also very much different. Differences actually as large as the differences caused in by the metallicity range over many more orders of magnitude. So we need to understand all of these features or details of this thermal evolution and also the reason for this diversity. But one thing to note is still we can see this characteristic feature of the dust cooling and temperature drop. Now, a more complete description, and just to show that we did everything in a very complicated manner without really assuming anything. This is the breakdown of heating and cooling rates. The heating rate dominated by adiabatic compression plus chemical heating, all mostly due to H2 formation. Cooling, there are a variety of processes, H2, HD, O1, OH, H2O, and finally dust cooling. If when we include a grain growth, the most of the silicon atoms are all locked into the silicate grains in the end. And we can explain these characteristic features in the thermal evolution by a variety of processes. I now tell you one by one. Recently, these people, Grassi et al., Bobino, they had a similarly sophisticated modeling, and even in the 3D case, we also are roughly consistent with each other. Okay, let me take a characteristic case of 10 to the minus 5 solar metallicity case. This is the gas temperature evolution, and this is the dust temperature evolution as a function of the density. So initially, gas cloud collapses, and then H2 cooling brings the temperature down to 100 Kelvin or so. Afterwards, HD cooling operates efficiently. Soon after that, OH cooling operates to keep the gas temperature low. You know, the gas still does not evolve adiabatically. This cooling operates to keep the evolution nearly isothermally. Afterwards, the cooling by water molecule operates. In chemistry, initially, most of the oxygen is in a neutral form, but via the reaction, it becomes OH, making OH cooling possible. And later, via this reaction, H2O cooling becomes important at these high densities. Okay. Now, so afterwards, I showed up to here. And afterwards, let's take this 10 to the minus 5 case also. This dust cooling operates to bring this, makes this temperature deep. But this, the depths of the temperature or strength of the cooling is really determined whether or not we implement the dust grain growth in this high density molecular gas cloud. We take a straightforward manner to calculate the grain growth. It's actually, again, usually this is one of my very maniac slides, but it's amusing to find some other people in this room are also like, you know, happy to discuss these things. And this was really my, I was very happy to find that. And usually this slide is really like, when I showed it, you know, this slide in a cosmological galaxy formation simulation, and nobody would really care about it. Anyway. If we multiply this equation by the grain radius square, then we can get the volume increase per impact with the key elements. And this simply scales with the number density and the cross-section and velocity. So it's actually easy to understand with some saturation factor depending on the temperature, if it did really occur. Also, because we are thinking about the very early universe, we don't include any radiation field. So here, this is assumption. We don't need, we don't include radiation, so there's no photodesorption of the dust elements. Now, whether or not, with or without grain growth affects the final morphology of this cloud, for example, this is with grain growth, this is without, and with grain growth, the efficient dust cooling promotes the formation of these clumps, for example, and overall morphology looks different. The same is true for H2 formation heating. With H2 formation heating, or I should say, without H2 formation heating, gas cools rapidly, so this gets thinner and thinner, makes this filamentary structure. But in reality, heating should really suppress the rapid collapse of this gas cloud core at this high density of, say, 10 to the 10th per cubic centimeter or above. Good. The effect of molecular cooling, OH and H2O, again, with these molecular coolings, the gas experience the rapid cooling to make this thin filament structure. Without that, we end up with these clumpy blobs, okay? So the whole complications, unless we implement these physics in a correct or, let's say, accurate manner, the outcome looks different. One thing particularly I was interested in and fascinated with is this two modes of fragmentation. Maybe you are familiar with either of these, but perhaps more familiar with this disk fragmentation we also often find in this low metallicity environment. Actually, even for the pure primordial case, zero metallicity case, we find with this calculation with Thomas Greif, we find this fragmentation of the circumstellar disk. So this is mainly, you know, the gravity-driven fragmentation of a disk. That's pretty familiar. But one thing we found in our 3D calculation is this intermediate filament formation, the filamentary structure. So typically the clamps are aligned within this filament with roughly the same separation. And some more controlled simulation case was shown by earlier work by Tsuribe and Omukai for this spinning disk and the filament to show the deformation of the cloud and this formation of clumps aligned along this straight line.
Look at pressure flow in those simulations.
I'm sorry?
Look at pressure flow.
Pressure flow?
Yeah.
What is that pressure flow?
We
don't have, no. What is that? Is it
numerical?
Ah, okay, okay. Oh, yes, sorry. Now I understand. Yes, 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 I do. To enable to the simulation past the formation, past the time of first protostar formation, we evolve this, for example, this system adiabatically. So it's effectively with a harder equation of state to allow the evolution of the other clumps. No, no, no. Only, no. So this guy does not collapse anymore because we want to follow the other thing. That's what we do. Yeah.
So once you don't have a sink particle, once there's a certain density reached, then you change the equation of state.
Yeah. But only for, 10 years or so, tens of years, yeah. So there is no like a significant dynamical interaction. That's maybe you were worried about. So anyway, this kind of classic story of cloud deformation and temperature evolution, where the gas cloud is cooling, then the cloud core becomes more and more elongated or deformed. Whereas when there's a heating process, there's either the fragmentation or the cloud core gets rounder. Okay. So we measure this core ellipticity in our simulations. Let's take this green curve, for example. This is temperature evolution. This temperature drop corresponds to the elongation of this core. This is basically the axis ratio. And then this H2 formation heating suppress this deformation. And again, this is enhanced by rapid dust cooling. So this the core morphology is significantly affected by the thermal evolution itself, as much expected. So after some experiments, we put this fragmentation criteria. So dust cooling must be efficient in the end. However, the H2 formation heating prior to the dust cooling must be efficient to prevent heating. Or it may be like OH or H2O cooling must be efficient, even though the H2 formation heating is efficient, something very complicated. But overall, it's like, cloud deformation gets rounder and deformation fragments. And the overall degree is really determined by the composition and the actual temperature evolution. And this is also seen by this more detailed plot of when this cooling saturates at the core, it gets slightly rounder, but then OH cooling operates to make it thinner. And finally, the rapid dust cooling produces these small clumps, okay, as interpreted or understood from the thermal evolution. Okay, and in the end, we can simply say, in a very rough manner, that for the diversity of this, even for the same metallicity, the diversity is caused overall by the collapse speed. You might want to recall Serena's talk on Tuesday. This overall collapse speed really affects the thermal and the chemical evolution. And we can encapsulate everything into this collapse time factor, F0. And then we can attribute the difference in the thermal evolution to this overall collapse time, collapse speed. Okay, so this is a summary plot for our 20 or so calculations, different halos. Different halos have different, say, collapse time scale due to the turbulence and due to the degree of spin and so on. Okay, and there are, so in this parameter space, like metallicity and collapse time scale, we place points. These solid points, or filled points, are the cases where we saw the vigorous fragmentation, whereas the open points, we saw only the central blob at the end. This is fairly complicated, but let me try in the next 5 minutes, okay? So in this parameter space, we can draw many curves comparing the cooling time, heating time, dynamical time, and so on. So we can make a judgment. So above this green line, the dust cooling is efficient, so things should, the gas clouds should fragment. However, there is a H2 formation heating effect here. So above which, but above this red line, they shouldn't fragment, consistent with what we, only this minor, small region, it's allowed to become fairly unstable. This regime, below this point, this regime is like a typical disk fragmentation, like we saw in even in the POP3 case, the circumstellar disk fragment gravitationally. That's not really our interest here so far. Above this, there is a region where OH or H2O cooling becomes efficient to make the cloud deformation. So we can have this vigorous fragmentation only for this case, like 10 to the minus 4 solar metallicity, and about a modest degree of rotational turbulence, the collapse support or so. So in this way, this two-parameter description gives a rough guide, and at least we can describe what happened. But it's far from complete, in a sense, this collapse time scale, collapse factor F0, contains too much information, actually. So it's, right now, it's or even though we can draw these curves for specific cases with specific abundance and so on, metallicity, but it's very hard to predict what's going to happen in the end. Okay, but this is still a nice plot to understand how low metallicity gas remains. I got 3 minutes. So this is near to the end of my story. We are left with this situation. So suppose we take the initial condition, okay? We take this starting point on your mark, and we want to predict which halo is going to produce a big star or so in my problem, okay? So suppose we are given like cloud mass, temperature, metallicity, abundances, halo spin, and so on, very precisely. It's still very hard to predict what's going to happen in the end. And the actual race is like this. Of course, I knew this guy is going to win because he's Usain Bolt. So, you know, knowing his history, I can easily. But, you know, but still, I can't understand what happened to the guy in the second lane. He was there, but he's not here anymore. So the actual star formation is very difficult, but we all I can think of is, you know, just to let the race go and then to see the result and understand later. But this is a first step there. You remember the diagram that I showed, the metallicity and collapse time scale. This is really the first step. And firstly, the metallicity is not the only key factor. Even the element abundances doesn't really tell us what's going to happen to the thermal and the chemical evolution. And well, the actual fragmentation and the deformation is more complicated. And things like grain growth or formation heating affects very well, very much. Overall behavior can be understood also for the ordinary low metallicity case, but for now our core doesn't include radiation field, so we can't make a very direct contact to the real present day universe, but that will be covered by the next speaker, Fred Adams. And the implications for the metal clusters and galactic archaeology will be spoken by Rafael later today. So that will complete our story, I think. Thank you for your attention.
Time for questions.
Calm down, I'm here, so don't worry. I'm not.
Yes, good morning, Dallas. That was really beautiful. Thank you. I'm just curious a little bit, just technically, what when you say H2 formation, you mean in the gas phase?
Both.
Is that what you mean?
So whenever I
can you just be specific, yeah, but just what the process is specifically. I mean, you're releasing energy in H2 formation, but do you mean in the gas phase, or is this grain formation, or what do you have?
We have both, like surface reaction and then the gas phase, H minus pass. But whenever H2 molecule is formed, the corresponding binding energy is.
Yeah, I understand. It's 4.8 EV, but you're taking it's binding energy is 4.8 EV.
Yeah,
but
yes.
But in your simulations, it mainly chemical gas phase heating, or is it grain heating? Is it formation on grains that's dominating?
Both.
Both?
Both. Whenever it's two molecules form. Yeah.
Thank you.
And for the grain formation, what do you use? Because we don't know. In our community, we don't know.
Anyway. That is a good point. Yeah.
Anyway, I had another question. First,
okay.
Thanks, it was really very nice. I appreciated a lot. I understood a lot of things. Can you put back the plot with the temperature and density?
Okay, anyway,
please.
Anything. I think I can have many, but for example,
what about
this?
Yeah,
what about this?
Whatever.
Good?
Okay. No. Yes, okay. It's okay. Because given, I have two questions.
Please.
Given the big densities, that the large densities that you have, first I wonder whether you included the three-body...
We do.
...for chemistry.
We do.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And second, at these densities, I bet that all the various lines that you are using are optically thick. And then if you are guided, for example, from what happens, what we see in Orion, you know, the spectrum actually is dominated by sulfur-bearing molecule.
Okay.
Because everything being optically thick, practically, sulfur becomes important in the cooling game. Okay.
Okay.
So that was my little comment.
I take your comments seriously. Well, the first question is, rapid the temperature rise is actually due to three-body H2 formation, actually, on this. Yeah.
For the H2?
Yes.
Or the chemistry?
Chemistry. What is that? The same thing, the formation, the three-body formation of H2 molecules. That
but I mean, also the other chemistry.
The other chemistry...
You're using... the kinetics
some of the species we actually there are like rapid reactions. Some of the species we use actually equilibrium chemistry at a given temperature and density, right? Mm-hmm. There's some others, the others we follow in a non-equilibrium way. So relatively complete, I think. And sulfur thing, I take it seriously to further improve.
Sorry, can I just ask for a continuing question?
Of course.
On the free body
That's
chemistry.
Why I'm happy to be here.
I think what she means is not just the formation of H2 through free bodies, but any chemistry that will occur through free body reactions,
Ooh.
Which may affect your CO, for example, or your water, which then, of course, affect your cooling. So if do you have free body chemistry apart from H2 formation by a free body?
Effectively, yes, but not at the level of your request, probably. In a sense, as I said, some of the species abundances were determined in assuming equilibrium state. So that's everything, right? Even like three-body, four-body possibly can determine this. But the other non-equilibrium part we calculate in mostly by two-body reactions. That is it. Okay.
It's true that at very high density, the three-body reaction can be important, but at that density range, the dust cooling dominates, so the molecular abundance does not matter, actually.
Depends.
It depends on the dust abundance, of course, but in all those cases, the dust cooling dominates.
So much dust
input,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Since it seems to me, one should look at the details, of course,
yes.
But
yeah.
General speaking, the dust grow, of course, plays a role here, because you need the dust if you want to cool with the dust, right? Am
yes.
I right? And do I say things correctly? So maybe you can, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Because again, one has to really look at the details. Maybe you can avoid taking more molecules because maybe you obtain the same.
You're right. All I can say is you can simply test with or without grain growth and can see the result. So we in a sense, we hope the true might be in between this and this. That's what we can do.
No, in fact,
the actual growth efficiency and so on, that's a lot detail. But of course, I'd like to learn more. Okay.
So very nice presentation. I'm trying to understand your initial conditions. So
all of this. Dash?
Yeah. So these are cosmological mini halos, yes, which presumably evolved from a zero metal SDK.
Oh, okay.
And
yes,
then
yes,
you've mixed in metals, because in reality, would to mix in metals, at some level, of course, would require enrichment from a star. And would you expect such initial conditions?
The answer is no. You are absolutely right. There is no real reason to take the mini halo. Maybe we should take like a larger halo after recollapse, after supernova explosion. But that would be more realistic. But let me say we first wanted to qualify these physics and thermal evolution. So we just randomly took this mini halo, but having many rotation and degree of turbulence and so on. So according to following your question, maybe the degree of turbulence might be much larger in the real situation when the things exploded and recollapsed and so on. But I can say you are absolutely right.
So, Naoki, my question is about the two fragmentation modes that you showed, the filamentary and the disfragmentation. I can imagine that you must have a difference in the angular momentum in the two cases, but you were starting with the same mini halo. So is it that different thermodynamics change the distribution of angular momentum during the collapse? Is that why you end up with these two different configurations, despite, I guess, you're starting from the same spin parameter in both cases?
Angular momentum transport.
Because it must be must be different.
This is different. But okay.
I thought you had the same also comparing, right?
Well, let's take the same object. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me clarify, Lucio. So, like things like this. This is really like after some time after the formation of the central object. So there is really the angular momentum driven disk here.
Right.
But this kind of fragmentation occurs during the pre-collapse phase. So in a sense, this is really like a purely thermally driven elongation and then fragmentation.
Okay.
And then that's why I discriminate these two cases. But when you ask.
You're not forming a disk in the other case. You know?
When you ask, eventually maybe this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be later stage, and then I don't know. I wouldn't. I wouldn't put sink particles, but we'll try hard to extend beyond 100 years or so. Good point. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a similar question on the angular momentum. So I would like you to outline. In slightly more detail how the angular momentum matters. Because like if you look at your mini halo one, in the bottom panel I can kind of see that things have pancaked to a disk and the angular momentum that you started with is contained in that sort of rotating structure. But in the second from the top, it looks like a line. So where's the angular momentum in that one? And second, how does the angular momentum in a global sense affect like your question of what's the most massive star you form?
Yeah. Okay, Fred, let me go back to
this. I realize that's a tough question. So I just want to see what we know so far, right?
That's what we all want to know. So the primary effect of the angular momentum or the global spin is really to change this collapse speed. High speed spin, this is slow collapse. Slow collapse tends to make gas temperature lower because of the chemistry and so on. And things become different. But what exactly is going to happen to the very central region? That is another issue. Just like I described, whether or not this filament is formed or this nice disk is formed is really like the result of even the history of this temperature evolution. Okay. So let's take let's take image, the third of halo. This has been like on the lowest temperature track. So what's slow collapse? And then there was no like filament formation and so on. At the end, we find only one single blob at the center. And this largely the remaining angular momentum was now in the form of this disk. In this case, mini halo one, there has been many cooling regime like OH cooling and so on. And then this filamentary structure is formed. So maybe when we think about the angular momentum, the whole object might be spinning. But in the different way that by then perhaps they are like multiple clumps. So that's what I can speculate.
Okay, so I wish to go back to the first part of your talk instead.
Thank you.
Because I'm more familiar with this.
Okay.
And I think it's very interesting what you were mentioning about the fact that you didn't measure the continuum, the underlying continuum of this galaxy. So, and I was wondering whether you can further comment on that with respect to your simulation prediction. So, the global metallicity of this galaxy seemed to be fairly high. So, do you have an idea of why you may have overpredicted the dust content? So you would have expected to measure the far infrared luminosity.
This is really the central issue. Rafaela, let me answer to this way. One major reason that we focus on the oxygen 3 line other than C2 is really like, you know, we are not sure about the C2 emission mechanism, you know. So to make sure this O3 H2 region dominate the originated line is much easier for us to model and predict, just like. However, if we do the same thing, and of course, I think this is C2, right? 115. So we should be like kind of predicting, and then the difference between this simulation result and the actual observation remains a mystery for us. So I can't really answer, but
can I make a comment that may be related to this, because that was going to be my question. One important difference when you try to compare this type of measurements to the local galaxies is that the only thing that you detect is the contrast against the background, no? And in this case, the background is a CMB at the redshift of interest, which has a very high temperature.
So, right.
So the only thing that you see is the delta T.
Ah.
If the excitation temperature of your line is the same as the CMB, of course, you're in equilibrium, you see absolutely nothing. And the same for the dust continuum. So it's a very important effect that you can easily correct for when you do the
simulation,
when you compare to the measurements.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay.
But you need to correct for that. No?
Yeah, that seat line is a difficult line. Well, anyway, this, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but I didn't know if these points were.
So this is actually the observation of the C2 line for the same object. This is O3 contour, and then we don't see three different epochs. We don't detect any significant C2 line here. And Rafael, the original question, I actually don't know. All I can say is this is just indicative of less neutral gas because of this, also from the small Lyman alpha velocity offset, which Masami can tell us, perhaps, you know, the relative offset of 100 kilometer per sec is relatively small compared to the other Lyman alpha emitters and lines. So this is really like a small amount of neutral hydrogen that perhaps makes C2 line emission difficult for this galaxy.
Just yeah, let me give you a brief comment about the dust continuum thing. I definitely agree that the CMB effect is very important, especially this high redshift. But even at around redshift 3 to 5, where the CMB effect is not very strong, but still you find the deficit of the IR luminosity with the given high star formation rate and the given metallicity measurement are not given, but still we see the similar thing. So it's quite puzzling, and now I think many of the theorists are working on to.
My only point is that to place those points in the same ballpark with the local galaxies, you need to correct for that effect, because otherwise your point.
And now using the Dacunha, Elizabeth Dacunha's relation, people collect that effect.
It's not even the Dacunha stuff, it's just the fact that in the equation for the measurement, there is a background term, you don't need to see the difference.
So just a quick question.
I just wondered on the plot where you showed the evolution of the dust temperature and the gas temperature versus density.
Mm-hmm.
So going to very high densities, the dust temperature was a lot less, and then you have dust cooling.
Mm-hmm.
Why are the dust and gas not collisionally coupled at those very high densities? Naively, I would expect the temperatures to be similar.
Ah, eventually it will. Let's take this Gustavo's. Where is that? We show the it's just a density issue. Here, there we go. There are the collisionally coupled. So eventually, yes. But you know, dust temperature remains really always very low compared to the gas temperature.
So what density do you need to get at for efficient coupling?
This is like, I think this is like 10 to the 14th or so. It's very high density. I'm sorry? Let me see. I really should have this number. Usually when this temperature dip is close, like 10 to the 12th or 10 to the 13th or somewhere around that, so it's very high density. Simon, you have a better idea.
Yeah, it basically scales as well over the magnitude
squared. Sure,
so
of course.
Pushes it up to very high.
This, yeah.
So very quick, how do you manage to add the dust accreting at these very high temperatures?
Mm-hmm. High temperatures. Okay.
Yeah.
We have a saturation factor as you find. So at that high density, actually, there is no more accreting because of this factor. So the depletion occurs a little bit lower than at lower density. Essentially, yes. All the silicon and the magnesium atom. Okay. Yeah. Basically, yes.
So thank you. Let's thank Naoki.
Thank you.
So, all right. So the next speaker is Brett Adams, who will tell us about the ionization processes, star formation, and young stellar objects.